If you look at the Middle East, their cultures have arisen on the backs of the petrodollar, right? And as they see that petrodollar order starting to break and crack, they were the fundamental beneficiaries. So they're in a position where they need to leap for something else.
We saw that one video of just that giant, cement truck running over all those Bitcoin miners. And then a bunch of Bitcoin miners in Russia got seized from another company as well. So do you think that they potentially were just using that as like a way to almost confiscate miners and then mine it for the government?
I think it's all bets are off. It's just basically, how does everybody get as much of their hands on Bitcoin as possible? It is in nobody's best interest to speak openly about what you're doing, unless you're just trying to win and dominate, like maybe a Donald Trump. Bitcoin adoption is kind of like an iceberg, right? We're just seeing the top of it. But really what's under the water is really what's driving the price action. The fact that ETFs now exist means that Wall Street now gets to come in and start to play with Bitcoin in a way they've not been able to. So I think typical TradFi games are gonna play themselves out here. Now, what I know about the human species is it doesn't matter if you're a DeFi degen or a TradFi degen, you're still driven by greed. So I think that the lessons that we all learned being in the Bitcoin industry with the FTX blow up and stuff, those weren't learned by TradFi. My working thesis at this point is TradFi plays some games that we're not even aware of right now, and that winds up being the blow-off top destroyer for this cycle, and then we've got another 4 years before it picks back up again. There is no way to avoid being a trader as a Bitcoin miner. Somebody somewhere has to make a decision when to sell Bitcoin, and that decision ultimately comes down to, hey, what do you think of the chart right now, right?
Bing bong. We are live here in Medellin, Colombia, here with the man, the myth, the legend, Kent Halliburton of Saz Mining. But Kent, before we get started on anything, I want to talk to you about the hash wars that are potentially about to break out now. We've got the Kingdom of Bhutan. We've got El Salvador openly mining Bitcoin. But there's rumors of Saudi Arabia, UAE, maybe Russia even mining Bitcoin. Do you think that not just the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve is going to be the first to do it, but also the war to get the most amount of hash rate, as our friend Max Kaiser has coined it?
Totally, man. I foresee, Bitcoin I think of as a digital frontier, right? And that means there's just this mad land rush that's going on. Right now, I think it's covert. I think the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve is gonna push that into overdrive. I do perceive it's going to happen. It's not a matter of if, but when. But I think the hash rate wars are also a part of that land rush that we're seeing. I mean, the ones that you didn't mention that are already on there are China, right? Yeah. They banned it, and there's still 20% of the hash rate that's coming from China, right? So Russia just unbanned Bitcoin mining. I think they called it crypto mining, but it's Bitcoin mining. I think it's all bets are off. It's just basically, how does everybody get as much of their hands on Bitcoin as possible? That's the game plan.
Yeah, and it's interesting because everybody seems to be on the search for, you know, cheaper energy, but China confiscated a bunch of Bitcoin miners and we don't really know what happened to them. Maybe we saw that one video of just that giant, cement truck running over all those Bitcoin miners. And then a bunch of Bitcoin miners in Russia got seized from another company as well. So do you think that they potentially were just using that as like a way to almost confiscate miners and then mine it for the government, like under the table?
I mean, the incentive is there, right? So can I say that it happened? No. Can I say it didn't happen? Also, no. I will say a personal experience that we've had, not personal, but an experience that we had in Paraguay, right? There was genuinely this thing, and it got misinterpreted on Twitter, but we're mining there in Paraguay, and there genuinely was like a lot of illegal mining. And what is illegal mining? It means like literally you're throwing a pair of jumper cables on the electric grid and using that electricity directly without paying it. It's stealing electricity, right?
Yeah.
So the government cracked down. When they cracked down, they found these mining farms that were illegally plugged into the grid, right? Not literally jumper cables, but you get my drift.
Yeah.
But they're illegally stealing this electricity. They came in and they confiscated all these mining rigs. Those mining rigs never showed back up on the market.
Yeah, where are they? I feel like those things are just like, it happens so often.
Yes.
Where like we hear about it, and then because it's the internet, you know, you hear about it on Twitter or something, and it's like, all right, where did these Bitcoin miners go? And they're just poof, gone. Like Puff the Magic Dragon, you see everything pop off, and then it's all of a sudden gone. So that makes me believe that some of these countries are just secretly mining Bitcoin. But with that, do you think that there's, I mean, a way that the United States could be potentially doing it? I know we had, maybe it was the city of Fort Worth that started doing it inside their city council building or something along those lines. But would the United States do it? And do you think that the United States would do it in a sense where they would try to do it secretly, like potentially some of these other countries are doing?
Well, I think we have a very unique moment in time with Donald Trump becoming president. There's a lot I think we've all learned about his character, that losing is not something he deals with well. I think that is a very true statement. So as a result, I think that if he perceives, and that's my belief right now based on what he said in Nashville and across, you know, the campaign trail that he was on, that he wants to win at this too, he's not going to sit back and let this ride. Now, what does that mean? What does he actually do? I have no idea. But I mean, let's say there's a lot of talk about getting nuclear reactors going in the U.S. Let's say he says, okay, we're going to get nuclear reactors going and we're going to backstop it with Bitcoin mining to help pay for these nuclear reactors. That could be a plausible way that he helps to spin things up more quickly and finance and pay for it, right? I mean, there's, who knows? I'm literally just throwing something that just came to mind right off the top of my head out here. But we don't know how it's going to play out. What we know is he doesn't like to lose. He supports Bitcoin. And there's a lot of energy that we're not totally accessing and developing in the U.S. right now that we need to if we're going to win at the Bitcoin hash wars.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, the way he's looking at green energy. He's like, all right, well, you know, why would we want a tank that's, you know, green energy if we're just getting blown to smithereens, essentially? I think, like, just tongue in cheek, that's essentially what he said. And the way he looks at energy, right, drill, baby, drill, it seems like he wants the U.S. to be more of an energy-dense country. So Bitcoin almost goes hand in hand with that. So I imagine that it's going to be a part of it. And I know a lot of Bitcoin miners have met with Trump previously, right before he got elected. And, you know, we're recording this on the 17th. So 3 days
in
before.
3 days, we get to find out.
Yeah, so 3 days, we get to see what actually happens.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I definitely think I'm bullish here going forward on what it is. I'm not sure where mining really fits in with his plan yet. And I don't even think he knows just yet. And so, is there something that you fear about this potential administration coming in with, you know, a lot of unknown coming in? Because the previous administration obviously was very anti-Bitcoin, very pro-green energy, right? Bitcoin mining was killing the environment. It was boiling the oceans. You know, you name the FUD that they were throwing around. This one seems to be, you know, as in Donald Trump, seems to be more pro-Bitcoin, but he also seems to be, you know, still on the learning curve a little bit.
Yeah, I think everything he said there is right. I mean, we know that he doesn't want to develop more government. We know he supports Bitcoin, and you know he wants to win at this game. So how does that play out? Again, I don't really know. And I know that I want to do more mining in the U.S. as a result, right? We have operations in the U.S., Paraguay, Norway right now. Now, that was strategic because the trajectory of the U.S. was different until he was elected. And that trajectory, I just didn't like the outlook for continuing to mine in the U.S. So I was not looking to put more resources into mining in the U.S. Now with this change, I'm thinking the exact opposite. I'm thinking, hey, look, there's more favorable conditions. I would rather do it. In fact, I think I heard one of the big miners, Hive, I believe, so speculative, I didn't go read and research myself, but makes sense. They cited moving to the U.S. recently because of favorable market conditions. So capital is looking to come in based already on what Trump has said and done. But to your point, does he really know what he's going to do at this point? I doubt it.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. I mean, I think he has a lot of smart people in his corner. And I think that's a Donald Trump superpower that he's been able to do, because obviously to build the empire that he has, he's had to put the right people in the right positions. And I think he's been able to do that very successfully. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. But I want to get into the Kingdom of Bhutan and some of these other countries that we know and that are openly mining Bitcoin. To be honest with you, I had zero clue where or if the Kingdom of Bhutan even existed before they announced that they were mining. And I think it even came out in like the Celsius lawsuit or something like that, where they were holding Bitcoin. But, you know, and because that lawsuit came out, that's how it was found that they were actually doing it. So, you know, long-winded answer to say, do you think a lot more smaller countries are mining and utilizing Bitcoin to try to I guess, like, elevate themselves after seeing the success that's happened in El Salvador, or maybe even been doing it longer than them in the first place?
Yeah, listen, I'm an incentive maximalist, right? So I like to follow incentives to what their natural conclusions are. It is in nobody's best interest to speak openly about what you're doing unless you're just trying to win and dominate, like maybe a Donald Trump, right? Like, yeah. I could see him actually being very public about what's going on, because almost everybody else sees the game theory as, the more I talk about it, the more other people are going to go buy it before I can get my hands on it, and that's going to push the price up. So I think there's a vested interest in being silent, actually, here. So my suspicion is that there's a lot more of everything going on than any of us really know. It's kind of like Bitcoin adoption is kind of like an iceberg, right? We're just seeing the top of it. But really, what's under the water is really what's driving the price action.
Yeah, so that's where I want to get into. A lot of these more energy-dense countries, like the Middle East, the BRICS countries.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, they've already talked about potentially building some sort of cryptocurrency. You know, I believe like Iran and Turkey have approved for international trade using Bitcoin and other cryptos. Do you think that they are going to be some of the leaders when it comes to Bitcoin mining, just because of the energy denseness of their countries, or and kind of like the resistance to the dollar, it seems?
Yeah, I think the Middle East is, of the places you talked, I would say is the most likely target from where I sit. Again, going back to incentives, right? If you look at the Middle East, their cultures have arisen on the backs of the petrodollar, right? Mm-hmm. And as they see that petrodollar order starting to break and crack, like, they were the fundamental beneficiaries. So they're in a position where they need to leap for something else, right? I mean, they still have the petroleum there, but like the security and the whole arrangement is changing. So it makes sense that they'd be sort of in a place where they would leap for it. They've got the cheap energy there and they can develop a lot of hash rate with that on the back of that incentive. So that's to me where I see the most interesting play coming, is sort of the Middle East, whether at Saudi Arabia, Dubai, UAE, like all that area to me is the most likely target, because they're culturally very different and distinct.
Yeah, so now I want to get into a little tinfoil hat with you. I know we've kind of started off with that in a sense, but the way that my mind works with this energy stuff is, what we've seen basically historically is wars over energy. So is there a world where we start to see wars over potentially hash rate? Because, you know, what we could have, like the Saudi Arabia, obviously the U.S. was in Afghanistan for so long for like oil and other things like that. So if some country seemingly tries to, you know, can take over as much hash rate as possible, do you see that as a potential, because of the incentives that are there, to potentially start a war over that? Obviously, in the Bitcoin space, we all think, you know, Bitcoin fixes everything. There's going to be no wars. It's going to be peaches and daisies. I think before we get to that world, there still might be some blood in the streets.
Oh, yeah. I think for the future that we all see, it's going to be really unlikely that we get there without a lot more volatility. I think we all kind of know what the end state of things is going to be, like hyper-Bitcoinization. The path to get there, though, is just really fraught with peril. And I think the easiest way is just continuing to see adoption slowly grind up into the right. The hard thing is if there's a sudden like break in the system, right? And we suddenly all have to reorganize quickly around that. We'll do it. But as far as where I see the wars coming in, I think it's actually not over the hash rate directly. What I see right now is actually the silicon. And the silicon, because there's layers of pent-up demand for that silicon. So I think the silicon supply chain is where the wars could happen. Like, for instance, there's a lot of silicon that's made in Taiwan, right? And Taiwan and China, there's this weird dance that's going on there right now. So I could see fighting over that silicon supply being a catalyst for war, right? But I think in general, and I know this is something else that's going on, like the U.S. is trying to reshore silicon production and chip production locally. But I think that the more that we get silicon production distributed across the globe, I think the actual I think that as a civilization, we'll be more safe from that particular vector. Because if you want to control hash rate right now, you can go for the silicon manufacturing facilities.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting that you're bringing that up, because I wanted to talk about that as well, because it seems Bitcoin miners, you know, semiconductors, all that are pretty centralized where they're manufactured.
Yeah, it's a problem.
And is that a huge risk?
Absolutely. I see it as a huge risk, because it's too much concentration of power, right? And if you're just manufacturing all the silicon in one place. And we've seen when power gets overly concentrated, that really brings out the worst in people, right? So I don't like it. I'm glad that we're starting to reshore and bring some into the US. And I think the sooner that's done, the better we all are.
Yeah, so with that, right, it's not just the Bitcoin miners, right? It seems like the semiconductor chips, the silicon, and everything along those lines. Why do you think China has had such leaps and bounds head start over the US, over everybody else from just manufacturing? Has it been demand? Has it been desire? Because obviously the demand is there, right? Is it an issue where the US just doesn't have the capability to manufacture something like that? Like, where's the disconnect? Why are we so far behind?
Quick break from this podcast episode to bring you the safest way to buy Bitcoin on the planet. You gotta go to the well, folks. That's right, the Bitcoin Well. They will help you buy Bitcoin and send it directly to your personal wallet. You can sell Bitcoin directly from your personal Bitcoin wallet. And on top of that, if you want to buy large amounts of Bitcoin, they've got some of the most competitive rates in the space where they've got great white glove service. I'll even help introduce you to my friends over at the Bitcoin Well to make sure that they're taking care of you when you want to go through the over-the-counter service. And on top of that, they help support you and the freedom technology that Bitcoin offers. So I wouldn't partner with a company that I don't use myself. So I use Bitcoin Well to make all of my Bitcoin purchases. So I highly recommend them. So why don't you go to thebitcoinwell.com/greencandle and you can sign up today and join the party at the well. Maybe even get some tokens where you could throw into the wishing well and potentially win some free sats as well. Enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
That's a great question. I don't know that I've got a good answer, but what comes to my mind is it sort of falls in the category like the Triffin dilemma, right? Because we have the global reserve dollar, it has incentivized us to outshore manufacturing, right? And that has to do with labor costs being cheaper elsewhere and dollar demand being offshore. So I don't know exactly how this dynamic came up to why we have so much of our silicon production located in antagonistic countries. Not healthy, not good. It's why it's being reshored. But yeah, we are where we are.
Yeah, 100%. And it seems like a lot of, it's not just like Bitcoin miners, no. Right? It's like all our computers, like a lot of things.
Like AI is pushing it too, right?
Yeah. And I think recently somebody was just telling me that new AI was just developed by China just shortly after ChatGPT. That's allegedly 10 times faster and 10 times more efficient. So it seems like that's going to be kind of the wave with AI and kind of Bitcoin mining almost like intersecting. Do you see those worlds as, I guess, similar and in a sense kind of driving each other up, whether it's AI data centers being paired, or how do you see that as somebody in the neck of that industry?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think it's easy from the outside to see them as more synergistic than I actually think they are. I think there's overlaps of synergy, and I'll try to break it down as simply as I can. But one thing I think that's been mistaken is that AI data centers are the same as Bitcoin mining data centers. Bitcoin mining data centers are a lot more primitive in terms of needs versus AI data centers. You know, they need to be spit polished. The uptimes need to be like absolute. It doesn't have to be with Bitcoin mining. And so people cut costs by reducing the infrastructure costs for Bitcoin mining. So I don't think that they can be the Bitcoin mines can be repurposed very well. However, what Bitcoin miners do have that AI data centers want is cheap power agreements.
Yeah.
And that's the real value that I think is coming from the Bitcoin miners is I think that AI companies could buy out Bitcoin miners or buy out facilities, just tear them down, get rid of them, rebuild what they want. But ultimately having that cheap power is what's going to drive that behavior. So that's what I see happening there. And then on the application side, so actually Bitcoin being out in the environment, I think it's a natural fit that as AI become, we allow it, this is naturally going to happen, to become more autonomous in our lives. It is naturally going to mean that we're going to be using more Bitcoin for those AI transactions. Not we, the AI agents between each other are going to use it because it's the only digital form of money that exists on the internet that is not being debased, right? And that everybody can sort of trust as being relatively stable and free. So I don't know how this all plays out, man, but those are the kind of the two overlaps. Bitcoin miners have got cheap electricity that AI wants, and I think AI is going to want to use Bitcoin for transactions.
Yeah, so there's been a big
FUD argument started lately about quantum computing. So I'm curious. Yeah, I'm curious as a Bitcoin miner, your thoughts on that. Like, is quantum computing going to be the end? Like, right, all Bitcoin mining is just going to be completely easy because quantum computing's coming. I mean, pack it up, man. We've already lost, right?
Yeah, game over. Game over. What are we doing here, bud? Yeah. No, I the way I look at it is, I think, first of all, quantum computing is, it seems like almost magical technology, right? Like, we really don't understand what the bleep is happening there, right?
Yeah.
But what I see happening is everybody's fixated on Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is, what, a $2 trillion asset? Like, how big is the economy running on the internet, right? Like, we're talking about HTTPS being destroyed, right? How are we going to have internet browsers? Like, if we're really breaking encryption, like, is Bitcoin the only thing that's a worry? I think it's easy to focus on, is what I'm saying. But the other part is, people, I think, confuse encryption for Bitcoin. And what I mean by that is, SHA-256 is the encryption protocol. That is a part of Bitcoin. That is not Bitcoin itself, right? That's just the encryption side of it. That SHA-256 protocol can be replaced. We can fork the network and upgrade the encryption technology and make it quantum proof. You know, that already exists. So it doesn't seem hard to me that we can get around this.
Yeah, I mean, and it definitely seems like that's just like the overall narrative. I've heard the other one where it's like, all right, what happens if the internet goes down? And I'm like, buddy, if the internet goes down, Bitcoin's going to be the last of your worries. You yes. can access your bank account. Like, I mean, 96%, I believe, or maybe 90% of the quote unquote dollars in circulation are not printed right now.
Yeah.
So you'd have 10% of the overall money supply if we just went to cash. We have so much debt right now. That's like, there's no way that would ever happen. So Bitcoin in general, I mean, you know, we live in an online world, as you're saying. So, but I want to get back to that, back to the AI and the AI agents, kind of like the use of both of those things, because it's two very rapidly developing industries. But you brought up the internet. One thing that I think is very interesting that I saw recently is that the adoption of internet was the fastest of any new technology next to Bitcoin, because Bitcoin now is being adopted by more people than the internet was. And people always compare the two. Now, with the development that we're seeing, we're hitting an all-time high today, over 100K, gradually, then suddenly, is this how you see it playing out, where now you're gonna need some sort of Bitcoin mining strategy, business corporation strategy with Bitcoin, you know, nation states are gonna need some sort of Bitcoin strategy, like, are we here? Do we make it? Is everything about to take over?
Oh, man, I was just talking to somebody recently about this. And I think what you're pointing to is, hey, is the Bitcoin cycle dead? Mm-hmm. Are we launching? Did we hit escape velocity? And my belief is not this cycle. I think it's very possible next cycle, though. Now, why I say not this cycle is because, for me, the fact that ETFs now exist means that Wall Street now gets to come in and start to play with Bitcoin in a way they've not been able to. So I think typical TradFi games are going to play themselves out here. Now, what I know about the human species is, it doesn't matter if you're a DeFi degen or a TradFi degen, you're still driven by greed. So I think that the lessons that we all learned being in the Bitcoin industry with the FTX blow up and stuff, those weren't learned by TradFi. So my working thesis at this point is, TradFi plays some games that we're not even aware of right now, and that winds up being the blow-off top destroyer for this cycle, and then we've got another 4 years before it picks back up again.
Well, a lot of what happened last cycle was leverage, right?
Yeah.
So I want to get into that as well, because obviously, you know, in the mining space, it's a tough business, right? You need to have the cheap energy. Last cycle, it seemed like a lot of Bitcoin miners were borrowing against their miners, which depreciate to, you know, buy more, and then everything just crashed, right?
Yep, that's what
now, do you believe in the Bitcoin halving cycle being a huge, significant driver on the price?
I do, until I don't.
Okay, explain that.
And so what I mean is, I do, because every time the halving has happened, this is my third cycle,
yeah,
I've heard the exact same arguments. Oh, it's priced in now. Oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, this, and every time it has. It has shown to have an impact, and the Bitcoin price cycle has basically played out identically the last three cycles so far. I mean, could it be different this cycle? Sure. Could this be the one where we hit escape velocity and the phase shifts, and now the global monetary order is reset?
Would love that to happen this cycle. I just don't personally think it's all that realistic.
Well, here's how I'll play devil's advocate. Is I think it is part, but it's not as big of a part as Bitcoiners give it for the price. And I'll explain, because obviously every 4 years we have the U.S. presidential election. This one seems to be the most significant with the price driving and everything like that. Following that, you know, we have the interest rates, environments, all those other things. But there's about 7% of coins left to be mined. So I think it's more of like the HODL behavior and the business cycles in the U.S. and the fiat world that we're living in is still a 4-year cycle as well. And so like these all kind of just coincidentally line up at the same time to make for massive volatility, where I think in a vacuum, if it was just the halving, you know, with more and more people kind of coming online, it would be more dependent on the energy prices. And those I don't think are as volatile as maybe I'm wrong. But those I feel aren't as volatile because of the contracts that these miners get for 2 to 4 years. And because of that, that doesn't necessarily drive the price up as significant. Now, it is a part of it, but I don't think it's the main reason. Do you feel me on that, or do you think?
Yeah, no, I don't think you're wrong. I don't think you're wrong. I don't know if you took the mining, the halving out of it, if those three other things you mentioned didn't cause the same 4-year cycle or not. I think the thing is, you just can't know. I think that they all collude and have an impact, but I don't think that we'll ever really know. But what I think is actually more important than all of those is the fact that the market now believes in the 4-year price cycle. It almost makes it a self-fulfilling prophecy. So even if, as long as, it's kind of like the placebo effect, right? Mm. Where it's like, we're all taking this pill called the 4-year price cycle and believing it's going to play out, and it does. You know, what's creating what here? I don't know.
Yeah, and it seems like that's going to be the tide that shifts. Now, you brought up, maybe it was pre-show, but we talked a little bit about, like, you know, the energy markets and kind of how that's developing. Nuclear seems to be the hot button topic. I think even Trump has brought up nuclear as, like, something that he really wants to look into.
I believe.
Now, is that going to be the next game changer when it comes to Bitcoin mining, just in general, just because of how much energy is left on the table currently in the nuclear industry? Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm gonna help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Yes, I don't know on that either. So I love the idea of nuclear. And I think that the timeframes for execution on nuclear thus far have been far longer than anybody has thought, right? Like, it seems like there's this growing swell of acceptance that we should do more nuclear, but how much time between the decision to say yes and the actual production of power is it, right? And that worries me, that time frame. Now, what I actually see, like, two trends right now that I think are dominant in the Bitcoin mining space. One is immersion and hydro-cooled. It seems like there's pretty much acceptance that that's where the industry is going. Mm-hmm. And that means less maintenance on equipment and lower energy usage per terahash. The other one that I actually think is more fascinating is heat recovery. Now, why heat recovery is important is because heat can be sold, and that lowers your operational expense, which is really your electricity costs, right? So effectively, you can reduce the cost per kilowatt hour you're paying by selling heat. And I think that's going to force a new level of competition on the network, where at some point it could scale to the point where if you haven't figured out a way to monetize your heat, even if you've got low cost power, you simply can't be cheap enough to actually compete.
Now, with the halving and everything going on, right? Well, I want to get into the business aspects of things, but do you think the personal mining is almost dead, like the at-home mining, unless you're using it for, like, say, a space heater?
That's a great question. No. And the reason why I don't think it'll ever die is because there's always the tinker in the garage that wants to play with this and be hands-on. And I think that's absolutely necessary, because it's the tinker in the garage that creates the zero to one invention that ultimately scales and helps us all. I'm absolutely convinced of that. So I never want to see it die. And at the same time, I don't think it's going to be economically feasible very much longer. In fact, I debate even if the heaters are going to work long term because of just the cost of the silicon, the equipment, how much energy is being used. I mean, maybe it does, but there's a kind of a last mile connectivity issue there, because if your heater is not connected to your Wi-Fi, how are you getting credit for the mining rewards, right? So like, yeah. And we all know our devices go on and offline all the time, right? So how do you keep that consistent? I don't know. Those issues can be solved. I'm not saying they won't, but for me, it's more fundamental that we figure out how to mine profitably to keep it going longer term. And that to me means still data centers. I don't see how you can't get cheap enough power any other way.
Yeah, 100%. And now with this development, right, with Bitcoin hitting 100K, it seemed like last cycle there was a lot of just countries not really embracing Bitcoin, whether it was Bitcoin mining, something along those lines. They were essentially saying, hey, you know what? You can't do this here. Now it seems like the tides are shifting with 25 different countries looking at potential for Bitcoin strategic reserve. Obviously, Bitcoin mining plays a part in that. Now, with your discussions with everything, have you seen it now after a couple cycles in get a little bit easier to have those discussions, whether it's with energy companies or governments or whatever, to potentially build a site in a different area? Like, does that not worry you as much anymore?
Worries me less, for sure. I think it's sort of turned the temperature down. It seems like we're hitting this collective crescendo. Like, Bitcoin has been an emotionally fraught word, right? Like, I actually think a good one, a good similar word would be like Trump, right? Like, there was a tipping point probably, what was it, 6-8 months ago, where, like, if you supported Trump at this point, that you were sort of ostracized and like, oh, weird.
Yeah.
And then there's a tipping point 6-8 months ago where it suddenly became socially acceptable, right? And I think Bitcoin is going through an analogous experience right now where I don't think it's quite hit the tipping point, but feels bloody close.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like everybody's shutting down, like the Elizabeth Warrens of the world, and everybody's kind of coming around. I mean, we even had the Democratic Party, like Kamala Harris, put, like, there was rumbling she was going to go and speak at the Bitcoin conference. Now, it seems like both parties on either side are now starting to embrace Bitcoin, and other countries are realizing, like, I mean, Italy tried to raise the capital gains tax on Bitcoin. They backed off. Everybody that's doing something negative towards Bitcoin backs off within a month. So it seems like everywhere is just saying, like, hey, the incentives are basically the people want it. And if you guys are going to be anti-Bitcoin, maybe anti-crypto to a certain extent too, everybody else is going to move and go to places that are more friendly. So, you know, as having mines in different places such as Paraguay and Norway, like, how are you looking at potentially branching out to other, you know, areas for, you know, maybe other mining facilities? Are you looking at, like, the geopolitical risks, or now is that less of a factor?
Yeah, I very much so. Yeah, still looking at that. I think of it more like how strong is the rule of law, right? That and is the rule of law in the favor of Bitcoin mining? Now, I think what you're saying is true. Like, the adoption and the uptick, a lot of companies are sort of like forced to concede that, yes, I got to adapt to what my citizens want. And for me, actually, as you were saying that, I don't know if you've ever read the book, The Sovereign Individual. It's really been friggin' prophetic. It's probably, outside of all the Bitcoin literature I've read, it's probably been the most impactful book, not Bitcoin related, that I've read. And it was all about how the sovereign individual was going to rise on the back of a form of currency that was outside government control. And I literally think that's exactly what we're witnessing right now, is they're witnessing all these nation states saying, hey, we don't like you, Mr. Bitcoiner or crypto guy over there, and we want to take some of your money from you. And they say, okay, goodbye. And they go to another jurisdiction that is not trying to do that, and governments are forced to react. And it's the first time that governments are in a position where they can't control that outcome. And so they're forced to redefine their calculus in the playbook they've been using. I think that's ultimately a good thing for shifting the power between the individual and the state.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just highlighting an example here, Kent, you and I met in El Salvador, then we're now here in Colombia. I believe you live in South America somewhere, and
Peru.
I live in the United States. And so, you know, we're meeting up in different countries, both of which where we don't live. And, you know, that's just kind of, you know, obviously for travel and whatnot, but it's kind of almost playing out a little bit of the sovereign individual where we're working in different areas of the world and not being bound to one specific place. And it's interesting because 4 years ago, when a certain thing happened to the world, that was a very novel concept, right? So, I mean, it's kind of crazy, but did you think reading the sovereign individual that we would be getting to where we're at right now and that Bitcoin was kind of that beacon? Or when you were initially reading it, were you just kind of thinking more on the freedom side of things and then Bitcoin was just secondary and then it kind of clicked later on?
Oh, I don't know if that framing is quite fits for me. I think I was already quite orange-pilled by the time I read The Sovereign Individual. But for me, the aha moment was, how did somebody in the 90s predict Bitcoin that wasn't going to exist for another 20 years? You know, that was the... 13 years. I think it was written 13 years before Bitcoin came into existence. So that blew my mind, is somebody could actually foresee that this would come about. But I think to your point, that ability for us to live and work where we want is really fundamental. So I was saying this pre-show, right? Mm. Like where I discovered Bitcoin, oddly enough, I had some time and space in life. I was living in a house that I was renting in the Sacred Valley of Peru. And that's when I could stare at the white paper and all the things and like, oh, wait, I've been traveling a lot and it's been a pain in the arse to be able to get my money to actually live in all these places. And with Bitcoin, I can be totally outside the system. Yeah, I'm going to buy some of that just because it's going to make my life easier. Now, for me, that was the aha moment. So to see that actually now come into fruition for like more and more people, it's like, it's amazing.
Yeah, it almost seems like a no-brainer. And but yeah, let's dive into that. So with, you know, utilizing your bank accounts and traveling around, did you ever have a situation, I guess, similar to what happened in Canada in 2020, where like people were shutting off the bank accounts or you lost access to your funds? Because it seems to be more common than people really, I guess, believe.
I'm taking a quick break from this podcast to tell you guys about Unbank. Unbank is a Bitcoin exchange with a network of ATMs all over the United States in trusted places like Costco. So you could buy and sell Bitcoin while you're getting a double chunk chocolate cookie. So on top of that, there's zero fees when you sell. That's right, I didn't stutter, folks. Zero fees. So you can visit over 28,000 locations all scattered across the US. They've been a trusted partner since 2014. And to start off this year hot, I've partnered with them to bring you a chance to win $200. That's right. Two cold smackers, two Ben Franks, two pieces of cheddar. All you have to do is download the app at unbank.com/greencandle and you'll be entered in a chance to win in the raffle that'll take place on February 28th. So enter now, enter quickly, enter often, and I'll see you guys all on February 28th for the chance for you to win $200. All right, enough for me, back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, personally speaking, yes, I've had many bank accounts shut down. My approach with it has always been to have multiple banks. That way I can always figure out a route. But what's been really interesting is that as I've lived through the space, so my first Bitcoin is late 2015, right? And like there's this constant like whack-a-mole sort of thing that's going on. You think you have things open up and working, then one day it's like, okay, it doesn't work anymore, it's broken. It's like always kind of figuring out like what works, when, how, and so yeah, I mean, it's a navigation for sure, but my perception is that we're almost past that stage. We're almost past the point of us having to do that. We're like the banking industry's fighting us and instead starting to accept us. I mean, I don't know if you read the papers that came out on Operation Chokepoint 2.0, but when those papers were written, I think it was the FDIC that wrote to the banks and said, hey, you got to cool it off. The banks were about ready to launch like all these like Bitcoin and various crypto products to the marketplace. The banks, that was the shocking part to me, is before the FDIC sent out this paperwork to say, hey, basically cool it, like all the banks were embracing it, right? So if we pull that off and allow the banks to embrace it, I actually don't think that the banks themselves are the bad guys. I think it's all the Bank Secrecy Act and all of like the regulatory burden that's been put on banks that sort of has deputized them that is the problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think a big part of that could be because I think it was the Clinton administration that changed the laws with banks, which allowed them to be investment advisors for people. Once that changed, basically like a JP Morgan Chase, for example, now has people that want Bitcoin products, they're going to listen to their clients, right? So I think that's what has kind of changed. And maybe that's why, because, you know, the investment advisors have just realized they've been getting their tail whipped by, you know, Aunt Sally, who just left her seed phrase in the safe and totally forgot she had like 10 Bitcoin just sitting there. And then all of a sudden it just takes off because her grandson bought her some, you know, years ago or whatever it is. And so that's where I think, like, you know, the difference is where the banks are starting to embrace it simply because they're realizing the effectively the return that you can get on that. Now, how are you looking at, like, not only just Bitcoin just as like a HODL aspect, with but in the mining industry, you know, they're looking at, you know, there's reports of how, you know, mining companies holding Bitcoin, how they're if they're holding Bitcoin on their balance sheet, it's looked as a premium. As a founder of a mining company, how are you looking at holding Bitcoin on the balance sheet? And maybe I'll toss in my two sats afterwards to see what you got.
Well, I think I first have to describe the business model that we run, because we're a mining as a service business, right?
Yeah.
And the way we've structured it is, okay, you come to our website, you buy a mining rig from a curated list that we've got. We get it procured, shipped, deployed on the rack. You set up a service plan and the Bitcoin goes to your wallet. So we don't make any money selling the rig or the electricity. Where we make money is when the payout comes from the mining pool, we instruct it to be split. We receive just 15%. What that means is now my interest is exactly aligned with yours, and my revenue, how I actually make money is coming from Bitcoin. So I have Bitcoin revenue, mm-hmm. right? And so for me as a business, I am now incentivized to focus on Bitcoin itself. So my entire revenue stream, not just treasury, is in Bitcoin. So I actually am forced to sell to dollars to operate the business, which is a unique position, because that now means that, like, I have friction just to sell. I always have to make the decision, can I figure out some other way to pay that bill, or do I have to sell my treasury, right? And that's the mindset that I think is healthy as a Bitcoiner, because I want to stack as much Bitcoin as possible to be able to build and outgrow like a fiat-oriented business.
Yeah, that is very interesting. So with that, how do you make those decisions? Do you just sell at the time? Are you looking at the markets trying to get a local top, or are you just riding the waves?
So I think this is actually probably like the dirty little secret of mining in general, is that there is no way to avoid being a trader as a Bitcoin miner. Somebody somewhere has to make a decision when to sell Bitcoin. And that decision ultimately comes down to, hey, what do you think of the chart right now, right? I mean, you can create some treasury management policies when Bitcoin is above, you know, let's say the 200-day moving average by such amount, we're going to trim some here. And, you know, yes, you can kind of come up with a strategy like that, but we're a fairly early stage startup. So it's like, okay, price seems down today. Like, let's wait a couple days. That bill's not due for a few more days, you know? Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, right? But like, that's the weird thing to me, is like every single mining company at some level, because their treasury is Bitcoin, is ultimately playing a game of like having kind of an internal fund, if you will.
Yeah, 100%. Now, the other aspect of mining that I don't think a lot of people really know about is the aspect that the pools are centralized and the pools aren't necessarily open sourced. Obviously, that isn't really attuned to the Bitcoin ethos. So I want to hear your opinion about that.
Yeah, no, I think this is one of the bigger concerns, genuinely, within the entire Bitcoin ecosystem. And I am glad that we can eventually participate in that solution. I wish I had a better solution for our company right now. But what I have seen, latest data, so Bob Burnett is an advisor to our company and a good friend, too. And I saw him just put out recently that about 41% of the network hash rate now consolidates all to Ant Pool. And it doesn't consolidate directly. There are proxy pools. And these proxy pools, they don't look like Ant Pool, but there's a contract on the background that ultimately means that they get there. And Ampoule is ultimately propped up and run by Bitmain, the biggest manufacturer, right? So there's this crazy consolidation of both hash rate and manufacturing equipment that I perceive as unhealthy for the industry, right? I think it needs to be diversified a bit more. So that's where the mining pool like Ocean comes in. We are working to integrate for our clients, so clients have the choice between Luxor, who we currently use, and they're not part of Ampoule, but they are still a centralized FPPS pool, which is just means to say that the element of luck has been abstracted from your mining rewards. You just get consistent mining rewards based on what has happened to the last 24 hours, right? Now, the thing with Ocean, though, is you only get the rewards that the pool generates, and the rewards come directly from the protocol. Versus when you mine from all these FPPS pools, it's one hop. So what does one hop mean? One hop means that the protocol pays the mining pool, and then the mining pool distributes based on shares for the work that you've done. Sorry to get overcomplicated, but at the end of the day, it's a problem.
Yeah, and it definitely seems to be like an issue that nobody really talks about. It's kind of just swept under, maybe because not a lot of people like outside of the mining space truly understand that, but you know, what are some of, obviously there's the 51% attack that people say that that's probably the biggest attack vector with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Now, do you agree with that one? And then two, like with these pools, what are some of the potential negatives or potential catastrophic outcomes that could come with some of the centralization of these pools?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to play the game theory here. I think what worries me is not the actual, like, I'm not actually worried about Bitmain, right? The revenue comes from Bitcoin mining hardware and mining pool rewards, let's say. Maybe some other little things that I don't really understand. But at the end of the day, they're vested, their revenue source is vested in the Bitcoin ecosystem. They'd be killing the golden goose if they were to try to jack the network, right? Hijack the network. So from my vantage point, I'm not so worried about that. But what does worry me is what if suddenly the state of China comes in and says, hey, Bitmain, you're no longer in charge. We're taking the reins here and we're going to do this. Like that, a state actor, a state attack, that's what worries me with the current setup and conditions. Good news is, it's 41%, right? We're not 51%, so they cannot do that. And that gives us time to act. But that's also where I think we have sort of a moral obligation to get the hash rate more decentralized.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's going to be something that is coming soon and something that more people are going to start to wake up to, especially during this cycle when we see other things come about. But with that, right, do you think that there's a potential of a nation state trying to get this 51% now with these hash wars we've been talking about from the beginning? Because it seems like the centralization is from the companies now, but countries got a lot more money than these companies, so they could really just put a bunch of money behind it and potentially go for it that way.
I mean, they could. They could. The 51%, I don't know. I mean, the only way for me that I could see that logically happening is if they fully debased the currency, right? Which by debasing the currency, you're going to create higher priced Bitcoin, which is going to encourage more miners to come into the ecosystem. So there's this like this price hash rate demand reflexivity loop that I can't in my head see actually how that all plays out. But yeah. I think will somebody simplistically say, yes, let's go for 51% hash rate? I think so. I think they'll try, but I think it'll be sort of like simple. Like, so one analogous thing that happens to me a lot in Bitcoin mining is a lot of people sort of newer to the space, they think, okay, cool. What if price goes up, right? Like, what does that do for my return with my Bitcoin mining investment? And I'll start to talk to them about it, and then I'll say, but you know, that's only one factor, the difficulty or the hash rate, that's the other factor. And if you're not thinking of both together, you're actually missing out. Because although the price is, you know, 100K right now, the hash rate is not the same as it was a year ago. So your rewards are not the same as when Bitcoin was, what, 30K this time last year? Even though, so your rewards are actually about the same as when they were 30K last year, even though the price has tripled, right? And so that's the thing, is like people are not keeping all the variables in mind. And I actually think that that's Bitcoin's strength, is most people can focus on one variable at a time, not two.
Yeah. So then with the halving, right? So I guess 100K,
Is it extremely profitable yet, or do we still have ways to go for the miners?
One of the most crooked industries, most fiat industries there is the health insurance industry. Let's be honest, you don't even need health insurance. If you could find somebody that would help you find awesome doctors, negotiate your bills, and fund those bills through a peer-to-peer funding platform, would you take it? That sounds pretty appealing to me, and that's why I've joined forces with CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is a place that you can do that all in one. One giant place, you can have a group of peers where they will help you find the best healthcare that you need. On top of all that, I can help get you a discount to get you on your feet and get everything started. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE for 3 months at $99. And with all of this, you will get the healthcare you need. You don't have to worry about going through to the doctor, negotiating, everything like that. Did you hit your deductible? Did you not? Is this insurance company gonna cover this claim? Is it not? You don't have to worry about any of that stress. And you can just get CrowdHealth behind you where they can help you get the number one place to have a health insurance alternative. So join the revolution. Go to joincrowdhealth.com. Tell them that Green Candle sent you. And join me and the rest of the great CrowdHealth users in this peer-to-peer funding platform. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, it's still not great. I mean, I think the simplistic metric that I like is hash price.
Yeah.
So hash price, I just looked at it. It's like 6 cents. It was 6 cents like the early part of last year. You know, so is mining more profitable today than it was a year ago? The answer is no.
Damn. Okay. So then we might be, well, hopefully then the Bitcoin price will obviously, you know, do what it does this year and everything will start. So right now it's not profitable, which is kind of surprising because...
Oh, I didn't say not profitable.
Well,
I'm saying
not
the profit
as profitable.
It's yeah, it's about the same profitability as this time last year.
Okay. That's interesting. Well, Ken, you've lived a very interesting life. You hinted at it a little bit earlier about how you found out about Bitcoin when you were in Peru. So I want to hear, you sound like a well-traveled man. Where's your favorite place that you traveled as we're sitting here in beautiful Medellin?
Let's get
to know Ken now, man.
Oh, God. So, yeah, my story is I worked in rooftop solar for about a decade. I was an executive there, and I had kind of an adventure in the early 1900s in my family, and I had his books, and they just inspired me as a kid. So I knew at some point I always wanted to go travel the world. So from 2014 to 2016, I threw on a backpack, and I saw a lot of the planet. I genuinely did. I think the places that stood out to me the most were the places that just had incredible raw beauty. And like Patagonia, Iceland, those are two of the places that really stuck out to me.
Did you see the Northern Lights?
I have not. And here's the really crazy part is we have a data center in Norway in the Arctic Circle where as we were turning it on and getting it live, the Arctic lights were going.
That's
so
sick.
I have a place that is like, I'm gonna get there.
You got to take a picture of that with the Northern Lights and the Bitcoin mining. That would be an electric picture to have, to say the very least.
Yeah.
I think that would be so cool. Okay, so then favorite kind of food or dish that you've eaten anywhere? Is there any meal that stuck out to you?
Oh, man. So along that sabbatical, right, I fell in love with a Portuguese woman and Bitcoin, right?
You
only heard the Bitcoin part. So I wound up in Portugal starting in 2016. And I'm actually a Portuguese citizen now through marriage and living there, you know, live the American dream in Portugal. But I would say the Portuguese food is the most underrated from an American perspective, and specifically bacalhau, which is salted codfish. And it sounds horrible when I describe it, but they make all sorts of dishes out of it. And once you acquire a taste for it, it's like, I crave it. Like genuinely, it's like probably the thing I miss the most in Peru is good Portuguese food.
Really? That's interesting. Yeah, because when I went to Portugal for Madeira, the conference earlier this year, the dish that they recommended, I don't know if it's just in a Madeira thing, but it was just basically like, I don't know, like a skewer full of beef. And I forgot what the name was, but it was delicious. And I was like, man, I ordered it like 2 or 3 times while I was out there for that 1 week. But yeah, I never tried the codfish. So I might have to go back to Portugal and try that. Okay, so most unusual thing that you've done in a different country. Like, for example, I went paragliding while I was here. I took surfing lessons in El Salvador. So what is something like that you've done that you could say that like stands out, one experience?
I think the biggest experience was I attempted to summit Aconcagua. Aconcagua is the biggest mountain in the Americas.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it's 7,000 meters. It was a true expedition. I had to get myself in shape and go for it. And so I started off my adventure in South America and Patagonia and did trekking for a couple weeks to sort of get my body in shape with the backpack, heavy backpack. And then I was like 2 to 3 weeks like on the mountain learning how to be a mountaineer and climb Aconcagua. And we had a bad weather window at the top.
No.
And so, you know, this is high elevation where you don't sleep very well. Like,
yeah.
Genuinely, like 6,000 plus meters. And like we were up at those elevation, we were stuck in a tent for a day or two with a partner and, you know, stinky socks and all the rest of it. I mean, horrible. And you know, the weather didn't work out. We couldn't even go for it.
Man, so was that a situation where if you would have gone for it, there could have been the potential to us not being even sitting here at that point?
100%. While we were there at base camp, there was a guy that that fell and died.
Wow.
And there was another guy that they had to pack down off the mountain and lost some fingers from frostbite.
Goodness.
Yeah. So it was legit safety, like and mount or peak fever, what do they call it? Mountain fever?
Yeah, mountain fever, something like that.
Yeah. When you just gotta get jonesing for the peak because you're so close,
yeah.
That's a real thing. Like I was struggling to contain myself because I, you know, the mountain climbing guy that was with us was like, nah, this is just too dangerous. You can't go for it. I was like, what if we do this? We do this.
Yeah. Just like trying to plot your way to make it. And exactly. The guy's like, hey, brother, don't even try this.
Yeah,
you go
out by yourself. We're not going to support you.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're not going to give you any medical care if something happens. It's like, all right, that's bad.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So then outside of that situation on the mountain, what is like the, or so are you a beach or a mountain guy? It sounds like you're a mountain guy.
Well, I mean, I went to California to surf and get a computer engineering degree. So
okay,
surfer first and mountain later.
Okay, interesting. So how good of a surfer are you?
I'll hold my own.
Are you a Kelly Slater type or what, man?
No.
No references.
No, I used to like sort of pushing my limits with bigger waves. So I lived in Ocean Beach, San Francisco, and that's a massive beach break that a lot of the guys from Mavericks would use as a training ground. I got my ass handed to me one day out there. I went out with the wrong equipment and I got out and I was just like, you know, if my leash breaks right now, I don't know if I can swim back in and survive. And that let me know that I was like driven on a career and I was like, there's a fork in the road right now. Either I'm going full-time like surfer, I'm going career mode, and I focused on the career.
So I
let it go. But yeah, I was sort of motivated to go for some bigger waves at one point and I let it go.
Okay, so do you have any big trips planned for 2025?
I think the biggest trip, like, so here's the thing. What happened to me is, like, I is absolutely a man with ants in my pants.
Yeah.
And I got them out through that, like, 2-year sabbatical that I went on and had. I got sick of living out of a backpack, as happened. And so now I'm quite happy and satisfied to be a family man. I mean, fun to come meet up with you and Medellin and have a great adventure with a bunch of Bitcoiners and stuff. But, you know, I'm excited to get back home and hang out with my family. So as far as adventures, the biggest one I have is because my wife is Portuguese. And I lived there for 6 years. Her family is like my family. And we're planning to go there for 6-8 weeks this fall. And, you know, the SAS mining organization, the rad part about it is we have staff that are in South America, North America, and Europe. So it'll make it easier for me to work with my European counterparts when we're there.
That's awesome. All right. Well, yeah, you mentioned it. Tell us a little bit about SAS mining, what you guys got going on. And tell us about it. I mean, you mentioned it briefly. But why don't you dive into some details, maybe some big things you guys got going ahead this year as well.
Yeah, so we got a different angle. I think that we're sort of the first mining company to really focus on what Bitcoin mining is as a Bitcoiner. And so what that means is like making the user experience accessible as a Bitcoiner. And so what Bitcoin mining represents to me is actually the ultimate way to dollar cost average into a Bitcoin position. Because what you're doing is you're cycling fiat through a piece of mining equipment, your mining rig, and the electricity on a monthly basis, and you're getting Bitcoin out, right? So if you think about it, you've got 3 years on the low end of useful life out of your mining rig. What you're doing is with your hardware and that electricity, you're spreading it out over those 3 years, and you're continuously dollar cost averaging. What's beautiful about that though is you no longer have to think, right? You set up you buy your mining rig, we get it deployed, you give us your Bitcoin address, you start getting the rewards, and you set up your service fee. Most people are using a credit card because they just want to cycle fiat into their Bitcoin position, right? And so as they're going through this process, they don't have to do anything. They just have to make sure their credit card keeps working and keeps paying for the electricity as it comes in. And we service and maintain the mining rig and take care of everything.
Yeah, so that's great. So how has SaaS mining been received by the Bitcoin community?
Skeptically.
Really?
And deservedly so, right? I don't give any pushback on that from the community, because there's been a lot of companies. So we call ourselves Bitcoin Mining as a Service, and we're fundamentally different because we've built a software layer around what's been more traditional, which is hosting. So we've created like a Web 2 experience for this, and we've aligned incentives. Remember, like I mentioned, that splitting of the block reward. So we now care about the exact same thing our customers do. If I'm not making your mining rig work, you're not getting rewards, neither am I, right? So we're directly impacted exactly the same. So for this reason, that alignment of incentives in the software, we're doing mining as a service versus hosting, which has been a traditional, hey, I'm gonna email you a contract, sign it, here are the terms. I promise I'm gonna keep your mining rig going, and what's going on? Oh, I don't really know. Let me go out to the farm and see what's going on. You know, it's been this like sort of really clunky process. And the problem with that has been that I have possession of something that you own, right? Mm. And that's a high trust relationship.
Yeah.
And it's also a high ticket purchase. So if you really want to have the capital flow in from clients that want to take advantage of this, you've got to deliver value and be trustworthy. And so that's where we put our emphasis, is like white glove service, deliver value to our clients.
Yeah, that's great. So now if anybody wants to check out SaaS Mining, where can they go? Where can they figure out more about SaaS Mining? And where can they find out more about my man, Kent Halliburton?
Right? Yeah. So SaaS Mining is sazmining.com. So go there, hit us up. You know, we've got chat bubble in the window. You can talk with our live agents. As far as me, at K Halliburton on Twitter, or X is the best place probably to reach me. DMs are open.
Okay, awesome stuff. So I'll put all that in the show notes. And Ken, man, I look forward to hanging out with you more down here in Medellin, Colombia. So let's get after it, man.
Yeah, thank you. Been fun.
Thank you for tuning into the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here, and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guest. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.